On November 12, 2013, 30-year-old Chelsea Small was fatally shot at her place of work, an American Cash Advance Center in Taylor, Michigan. During these events, the suspect was caught on surveillance brutally murdering Chelsea. His face was unfortunately unable to be seen due to the low CCTV quality. It was quick, with him only being in and out in no more than 60 seconds. What was the motive? What made him go in there on that serene November day and murder her without reason? Was this a planned attack? In this episode, we will continue to unfold all of the details of this case, with the newfound breakthroughs that law enforcement tried their best to suppress, and the unheard interviews with the mother of Chelsea Small and many more. Continue listening in to learn more about Chelsea Small, who she was, and the events that unfolded on this episode of Underestimated. They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
When investigating these cases, we want to make sure we don't lose the focus on the victims and who they were within the chaos of the suspect and the crime that has occurred. We interviewed Debbie Kamen, the mother of Chelsea Small, and she shared her memories of Chelsea and who she was.
Chelsea was my second daughter. I had lost a baby before her. She was my second. And then I had another daughter, Tiffany, after her. So Chelsea was a very outgoing child and a very, very sassy and outgoing teenager. And she was one of those type that when you say something to her, she always had a response right off the bat. You know, very fun loving. The smile was always very genuine. She was good people, as we say. You know, she was just a really good human being. She loved her babies when she had them, and they were her first priority. That is the reason for her going to work.
As Debbie stated, Chelsea was a good person. She was upbeat, someone who had a good sense of humor and would light up the room when she walked in. She lived a good life, having two kids and going back to school to get her degree in physical therapy at Wayne County Community College. She worked hard for her kids and wanted a bright future for them. Her life in Taylor was as normal as it gets. She didn't have any known enemies, no criminal record, didn't gamble, had no debts, and was not a drug addict. She did have an ex-boyfriend, Rick Farley, the father of her children, who was then cleared by police during the investigations. They kept an amicable relationship after the parting for their children. The risk factor for her was low. Between her working and taking care of her children and school, she didn't spend a lot of time out. When she did go out, she would tend to go out with family or friends. They would go to bars to drink and play darts. During the police investigations, they went through her phone records and didn't find anything out of place or concerning.
You know, we secured electronic devices and things like that, and we had all of those scoured and checked, and nothing stood out there either. No recent breakups. No. We'd interviewed a couple different gentlemen that she had been speaking to, but all of those interviews, you know, they yielded negative results. That none of those people ended up being developed as suspects or had any concerns about them as potentially being involved.
Or playing darts, but any indication of like drug abuse, sex work, any of those higher risk factors?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. All indications are that a very devoted mother to her kids.
The voice you just heard was a voice of Stephen Schwein, the lead investigator that was on the case from the very beginning. With all of the evidence and investigation they did on Chelsea to see how her life was outside of work and if there were any risk factors, they came to the conclusion that Chelsea had quite a normal life. So who would do that to her? It wasn't a normal robbery. He got there, shot her 2 times, and was out within 53 seconds. Now that we know who Chelsea was, we are now going to break down the events that happened on the day she was murdered. In the morning around 10 a.m., Chelsea and her mother were on the phone. Chelsea had told her mom that she had to go do a money drop and that she would call her back in a little bit. Usually there was times where Chelsea was intimidated by being alone, so she would call her mother just to keep her on the phone while she was doing her drop so she could hear what was going on. That morning, she did not have any time to do that. Around 12 in the afternoon, officers were dispatched to the Cash Advance store due to a holdup alarm that was pushed.
So, back in November 12th of 2013, shortly after noon, about 12:03 in the afternoon, our officers were dispatched to the Cash Advance store on Telegraph Road in Taylor on the report of a holdup alarm. When the uniform officers arrived, they found the location locked. There were two doors, the front entry glass door and then a rear door. Both were locked. They knocked on the window, got no answer, knew the business to have been opened previously. That's what the alarm company had told us. After receiving no answer for about a half minute or so, the officers broke the glass of the door, entered the location, and found Chelsea deceased behind the front counter. She had suffered 2 gunshot wounds.
Quickly, the scene was secure and investigators were dispatched to the scene. Private investigator Stephen Schwein was the lead on this case. He had worked closely with Chelsea's family as the case was being worked on. As they went through the scene, they were able to locate the CCTV footage to figure out what had happened.
The location is secured to a certain degree. You have to be buzzed into the business. So Chelsea had to hit a button and allow the defendant into the location.
So my first question is, what does the timeline look like between when the suspect entered the building and from the time when he left?
About 53 seconds, give or take. So he enters the store. He walks up to the counter, as can be seen in video. I'm not sure what you guys have located online and what you've seen. Obviously, there's more surveillance video that we have. We obviously edited portions of the video that's out online, but regardless, he walks in, he approaches the counter, he's carrying a drawstring backpack or like one of those sports backpacks. He sets it on the counter. He said something briefly to her, and within a matter of 4 or 5 seconds, he produces a pistol out of the bag and he shoots her once in the chest. And he, behind the counter and fired into Chelsea at the time of being a fatal wound. He goes to the back of the store out of camera view, rummages through some of the cupboards. We're assuming that he's looking for the safe or cash in the location. He comes back to the camera, walks over to the cash register, takes a small amount of money out of the cash register, and then exits out the door very calmly.
This was such an unusual behavior. With there being roughly around $1,000 in the store, why would he only take around $240 to $250? If he was there to rob the place, you would think he would take all of the money he could, but that was not the case. While the investigation was taking place, hundreds of fingerprints were taken from the scene. Unfortunately, there was no fingerprints from the perpetrator due to the fact that he was wearing gloves when the murder took place. They were able to locate the video system and the cartridge the bullet was in. In an interview with Stephen Schwein, he states that in the hundreds of robbery cases, this is the first one he has seen that has involved a suppressor. This really stood out to him and also my group.
I had almost 28 years as a police officer, 22 years with the city of Taylor, an investigator or a detective there for 15 years. Of those 15 years, I worked robberies almost the entire time, handled hundreds of them. Never once seen a case as quick and as brutal as that. And something that we haven't talked about up until this point is that I believe, based on the surveillance video, what we see in it, that there was likely a suppressor or what they call a silencer on the pistol. And never in my experience, not that I'm some worldly guy, right, but handled lots and lots of cases, never seen one that involved a suppressor.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
When looking into theories, there were many different possibilities. The suspect is described as a white male between 35 and 50 years old. His height is approximately 5'10", and he is a stocky guy. Also, his hair is dark brown and shoulder length. At the time of the incident, he was wearing a white t-shirt, dark jacket, dark pants, tan shoes, and a dark colored hat with a light colored logo on the front and left side. Notably, he walked with a slouched gait and appeared proficient with firearms. The suspect had a certain demeanor about him which seems like a sociopath behavior. This would be the type of mental illness in which a person could function in everyday life. The suspect seemed to have functioned very well. If he was a drug addict, he most likely would have freaked out or had erratic behavior. If he was a normal person, he would have panicked as well. Those are important things to mention because the gun got jammed and he didn't freak out about it or show any emotion to what he had done. It was mentioned that the suspect could have been a hitman, but with that being said, if he was just a hitman, why would he have been rummaging through the drawers and lurking behind the counter like he's looking for something? Another theory is that he was an ex-military, ex-police, or militia, etc. This is one of the top theories because of the gun jamming and him being able to react to it and fix it.
I would agree with previous military or law enforcement experience just because the footage of him clearing the malfunction is very smooth. He doesn't check to see what's wrong. He just immediately goes to clearing the malfunction out of the chamber. And that's something that's usually taught over several classes, armed classes.
There also could have been some gang affiliation. One gang that was mentioned was the Highwaymen MC, which is an outlaw motorcycle gang in Michigan and other states.
And then as far as like trying to look for more suspects, motorcycle club by the name of the Highwaymen, they're pretty prevalent in the area. They're not usually violent, but they do have their factions that engage in gang-on-gang crime. A few victimless crimes they've been not hounded for, but have made the local news for.
Throughout the investigation, when they were looking for suspects, one thing that stood out was that he might not even be a Taylor native. With that being said, if he was from around this area, someone might have seen him or known him. So hopefully with all these theories, we can dig deep down into the investigation to trace back the suspect's steps and connect the suspect to Chelsea.
A few months before the fateful day that Chelsea was murdered, there was a robbery at a sporting goods store in Jackson, Michigan.
just a little under 2 hours away from Taylor, Michigan, called Shootbox. On November 9th in 2013, an unidentified white male entered the sporting goods store at 4:08 p.m. during the business hours and then hid upstairs in the archery area until they closed at 5 p.m. He stayed hidden upstairs in the archery area for a few hours after the store had closed before finally emerging from hiding to start to look around for the items he had wanted to steal. He searched for items for about 40 minutes, taking his time while using his flashlight that he had brought, and even pulling out a ladder to look on top of the shelves for an unknown item. He mainly focused on taking suppressors, in total taking 16 of all different types and sizes, although there were three main sizes taken: multiple 7.62 millimeters, 9 millimeters, and multiple 5.56 millimeters.
So the Shootbox sporting goods store was robbed a few months before the murder. And what stuck out to us was the types of things stolen. So there were suppressors missing. And it's a wide variety of calibers. We had the 5.56 round. I think there was a 7.62 suppressor, a 9mm. But there was also a couple suppressors stolen in the caliber of the murder weapon, which was 45 ACP. And that's what stuck out. We weren't too sure if we would find evidence like that, but we knew that this sporting goods store sold weapons, sold suppressors, and the suppressor being the unique piece in the Chelsea Small case.
All of the suppressors that he had taken totaled to a value $15,694.96. However, five of the suppressors that he had taken were recovered outside the store. Police took pictures of them before returning them to Shootbox. He had also taken the time to open one of the gun cabinets and had taken two specific guns, a Walther PPK and an MSA2 long gun. He then put all of the items he had taken into a postal box, tucking it under his arm and walking out the front door in a rush, which caused him to drop the five suppressors so he could get away. The suspect that was caught on the one working camera in the store was a heavy-built white male wearing a ski mask that covered most of his face, hiding his face from the camera and making it impossible to identify him. He was wearing a white button-down shirt and an unknown style of cargo pants, along with a pair of light brown boots that were possibly work boots of some sort. He also had a watch on his left wrist and a holster, which possibly contained a handgun, on his right. He had tied a flashlight around his neck with a string, so he could easily use it while searching, along with a pair of gloves as he searched. The man caught on camera murdering Chelsea on that November afternoon was dressed almost exactly the same as the man from Shootbox. The suspect from America Cash Advance had on a blue long-sleeve button-down shirt that looked to be a work uniform of some kind, along with a white shirt underneath of it. He had on a pair of black pants that looked to be either cargo pants or some type of work pants, along with a pair of light brown boots that looked to be part of his possible work uniform. The suspect also was wearing a hat that was a darker color, effectively covering his face, just like the man from the sporting goods store.
Chelsea didn't have any risk factors besides the fact that she was working alone. She was known to be a very nice and outgoing person, and the facts that make up this case are incredibly abnormal. Up next, we'll be analyzing the CCTV footage from when the robbery went down and a possible escape route with these strings to explore. We will attempt to find leads from traffic cameras, nearby surveillances, and other nearby sources. We will also be analyzing the perpetrator's actions with relation to Chelsea's and the possibility of her knowing him or triggering him due to her use of the emergency button.
Underestimated, Chelsea Small was researched, written, and produced by Alexandra, Miley, Adeline, Tiffany, Emily, Cheyenne, and Shay. Intro music by Haley. All other music by Shane Yoder. Our show's artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was created by Emily.
The Underestimated Podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community Schools Broadcasting CTE program. We wanted to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping to fund our work. Please make sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcast player, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.